Welcome to the BFM Historical Society. This week, we talk to Debbie Gibbs, a person who played a pivotal role during what was an important transitional period in the station's history. Debbie plays some of the music that has haunted her for many years. Welcome to the BFM Historical Society, Debbie Gibbs.
Thank you. Nice to be here.
Back to the start. When was the first time you got involved in BFM and how did that happen?
I think it would have been, 83 or 84. And it was when the station was a part-time AM station. And it was about the first thing I did when I enrolled at university was walk in the door at BFM and ask if I could be involved. And at that stage, it was very male. And Andrew, I think there were about five or six Andrews and very few other people around. I think there might have been one other woman, but there weren't many, and they were struggling with political implications of being an all-male domain on the university campus, and so they were more than enthusiastic to adopt any stray female that walked in the door, regardless of her abilities. So that's how I managed to elbow my way in.
Had you listened to BFM before you
came? I had. And I mean, I'd been going to see live bands and stuff for a long time, and I'd organised concerts and things, and you know, I was really into music, so that was definitely what inspired me to head this way. While I was at architecture school, I did acoustics and sound system design and all that sort of thing, so that if I did end up being a practising architect, I would have the technical knowledge to back up my personal understanding of the way radio stations and venues and those sorts of things work, so that I could combine them and design them if I went that way. But in the end, architecture sort of fell by the wayside, although I still think it's a fantastic education, and that it's such a great combination of aesthetics and social considerations and practical engineering and physics and so forth. It just covers the gamut. And, you know, you don't realise how much it affects the way people move and interact and so on. So that whole social aspect of it and is really interesting too. I think I had to read the news for a couple of weeks and then I was up and running on air. That threw me in pretty quickly. Like I said, it was I was in the fortunate position of being a much needed commodity at the time, so it gave me a fast track. Plus, you know, don't forget, it was part-time, so there were no overnight slots for people to practice in and so forth. It was pretty much prime time, 7 a.m. to 10 p.m. or something, so it's not like they could put you on a midnight shift to give you a bit of practice, and you sort of got thrown in at a peak hour, because there was no such thing as off-peak hours. And in those days, the breakfast slot was the start. You know, the station would start at 7 o'clock
when the breakfast
DJ came in.
Yeah, yeah.
That was funny, because there were so many people that I knew that would just leave their radio on rather than set it and just expect it to go off at 7 o'clock in the morning and wake them up. And there was one morning I was on the breakfast show and my alarm hadn't gone off. I'd probably left it tuned to BFM. And the phone rang, and I picked up the phone asleep, essentially, and said, BFM. And it was Chris Esther, who was the program director at the time, saying, it should be, but it's not. And I was like, oh no. Leapt out of bed, threw on a dress, jumped on my scooter with no shoes on or anything, raced into the radio station and was like taking a corner too fast on gravel, and the bike started sliding up from under me. I put my foot down and didn't quite realize it, but actually sort of cut the whole flap off the ball of my foot open. And I got back on the bike, kept going, parked the bike at the bottom of the stairs, hobbled up three flights of stairs, leaving a trail of blood behind me, and got upstairs and put about two songs on before I could actually talk, at which point I just came on air and said, if there's anyone from BFM listening, could you call the studio, please?
First aid kit.
Well, it was more like hospital stitches.
Oh,
but
my God.
The guy that showed up in response to my my plea for help said that he arrived downstairs and there was this pool of blood on my scooter and this trail of blood up the stairs, and he was just following it going, oh, my God. It was one of the many times that we put Kraftwerk to good use. For me, most of the songs that are from that era have ended up sort of laden with memories and experiences and things. And I've always been a huge Velvet Underground fan and loved having both John Cale and Lou Reed both came and played in Auckland while I was at BFM, and we were involved in the promotion and marketing for those shows. And then the first time Straightjacket Fits went to America, first time we arrived in New York, we were riding in a car service from the airport, and the taxi driver was playing Coney Island Baby, and we just thought, this is the most awesome New York arrival ever. And Lou's kind of recurred in my life periodically, and he's now my curmudgeonly neighbour, along with Laurie Anderson, who are constantly trying to rally people against some, at the moment it's a salt storage facility a few blocks from us, and the funniest thing about him as a neighbourhood activist is that he's just his own worst enemy. He's the worst possible spokesperson for a cause. You put him on TV on an interview and he just blows it badly, but he, you know, is just a masterful musician. I've ended up having producers try and mix things that he's produced for other artists and so on. He's a character and a half, and he's just someone that's sort of recurred repeatedly through my life and interest in radio, and this is one of his classics.
Holly came from Miami, FLA, hitchhiked her way across USA, plucked her eyebrows on the way, shaved her legs, and then he was a she. She says, hey babe, take a walk on the wild side. Said, hey honey, take a walk on the wild side. Candy came from out on the island. In the back room, she was everybody's darling. But she never lost her head, even when she was given head. She says, hey babe, take a walk on the wild side. Said, hey babe, take a walk on the wild side. And the colored girls go doo 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 doo. Little Joe never once gave it away. Everybody had to pay and pay. A hustle here and a hustle there. New York City is the place where they said, hey babe, take a walk on the wild side. I said, hey Joe, take a walk on the wild side. Sugar Plum Fairy came and hit the streets, looking for soul food and a place to eat. Went to the Apollo, you should have seen him go, go, go. They said, hey sugar, take a walk on the wild side. I said, hey babe, take a walk on the wild side. All right. Ha. Jackie is just speeding away. Thought she was James Dean for a day. Then I guess she had to crash. Valium would have helped that patch. I said, hey babe, take a walk on the wild side. I said, hey honey, take a walk on the wild side. And the colored girls say, doot doo 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 doo. Do
I was encouraged to run for station manager for political reasons. You know, BFM was trying to convince the, you know, student association that it was a viable entity that had interest and impact outside of a small group of white males, and that it could reach a wider audience, and having the first female station manager was sort of considered would be helpful in that process. And I had no idea what I was getting myself into, so I was more than happy.
How old were you then?
18. I know, crazy, isn't it? And then I think they promptly had swift regrets as we managed to outmaneuver them with the students and the student association. They'd been trying for a long time to get a quorum of a general meeting so that they could pass various administrative things, and they kept failing to get sufficient students to show up. And we were trying to get the station a full-time permit and a loan so that we could go FM, which was obviously going to be the future for music. And so we called an AGM ourselves and rallied the troops and had stacks of students show up to the rec hall. And I think the Student Association was somewhat taken aback that we could rally those sorts of numbers and get our interests seen to and passed by our student supporters. I think they felt that our audience was all off campus, and they were surprised to find out that in actual fact BFM really was the voice for more of the student body than they realised. They'd sort of thought of Crackham as the real voice of the students. And in reality, I think they were surprised to find out that more students were listening to and relating to a music-based radio station than a political magazine. Well, when I started, the B really only ran through the orientation period. It was a very part-time station, and that just didn't seem viable. You will never build an audience for a station that, you know, goes off air for such long periods of time. So the first thing we did was string together those back-to-back licenses. And but it was also pretty obvious that for people that were really into music, that AM wasn't where you wanted to be. So, you know, all I was trying to do really was establish a viable long-term basis for an alternative music radio station. And there was just no way being a part-time AM station was going to cut it. So it was really a matter of incrementally setting up the hours and then making the shift to FM. So those were the big things that we did, you know, structurally in terms of the station. But for me, a lot of my favourite things about B were actually not anything to do with broadcasting. It was all the logos and concerts. And I did this whole series of concerts where we would put together a big Auckland band with a band that were travelling from Christchurch and Dunedin, and quite often the Auckland show was actually the reason that they'd put, you know, the South Island band would put together their tour in order to coordinate with a gig that we were doing. And I used to love putting those shows together, really interesting combinations of bands, and starting the magazine, doing
The Book of Biffin.
Yeah, and doing the compilation album, Outnumbered by Sheep. For me, a lot of the most fun was that stuff that I did on the basis that it was sort of marketing for the station. But really for me, the primary driving force had always been about, you know, promoting music. Mm. So extending the station's effectiveness and impact by actually generating new things like gigs and records and fanzines and so on, and putting all of that behind getting people interested in new music and supporting local bands and stuff, that was really the thing that I loved more than being a DJ. I think being a student station, being alternative, arguing that we were playing music that the other stations weren't playing, that we were promoting New Zealand music, all of those things really worked in our favour in terms of getting one of those early FM licences. I had never overtly sort of thought of us as a competition for the commercial FM stations, but it was very funny because my father was on the board of Hauraki, And he came home one day and he was laughing and saying, "Well, you must be doing a hell of a good job, Debbie, because your little radio station came up in our board meeting the other day and Haraki is scared shitless." So that was the first time I realised that they'd actually, you know, paid any attention to us and thought we were stealing their audience. But as far as I was concerned, if they wanted to appeal to our audience, they had to play the music we were playing, and they weren't about to do that. In those days when it wasn't about buying frequencies, it was about applying and, you know, getting governmental permission, which is quite a bizarre concept, but the fact that that was the process. You know, we had to put in a lot of material to prove that anybody was listening at all, because we had to draw this fine line between there aren't very many people listening. We're not a super commercial mainstream station, but there are enough people listening for it to matter, and what we're doing is different and matters. You know, New Zealand music was a big part of the argument. The New Zealand music industry, also being the voice of the students and that whole sort of news and issues exploration, all the specialist shows, all those other genres of music that didn't have their own radio station back in those days. So that made the application process a relatively clear argument. We just had to put it strongly, so it wasn't rocket science. You know, I remember it being a long, involved process, but not particularly hard. I don't think anybody ever mounted a convincing argument against us.
Five hits in a row, non-stop. That's what we do.
But it's not what we do. We do this. 95 BFM.
This is a song that, again, has a lot of personal associations and memories. It was written about a friend of mine, by a friend of mine, and it's just a beautiful, beautiful piece of music. This is Shane Carter and Peter Jeffries, Randolph's Going Home.
Thank you.
apparently Shane played that at the release party for Stroke, which would have been absolutely awesome. I wish I was there. Everyone said it was amazing. It's a beautiful song, and, you know, the Double Happies were good friends, and I, you know, really remember that a couple of them had been staying with me when they were on that last tour, and I remember Barbara going to rescue Shane and John after Wayne died and bringing them back up to Auckland. And so, as with most of the songs I've chosen, it has just a lot of associations about people and occasions and places, and that was just, it must have been an incredibly difficult thing for Shane to do, writing that, and it's just astonishing to me that that's what came of his efforts. I do have hazy memories of BFM's first FM broadcast. I had replaced myself with Jude. At that stage, I was really, you know, working in tandem with Jude, because I had decided that once we'd done the work of setting it up, when the station launched, I wanted to be doing the marketing and, you know, the promotion stuff. So that's really was my focus. But, you know, Jude and I together did the logistical things, along with, you know, we had great tech people, Dave and so forth. And but yeah, it was a pretty awesome day for all of us to actually, you know, have our audience be able to hear the music the way we were playing it in FM. Mm. So it's funny to think of now, isn't it? How long ago was that? I'm not sure if B would have been had much of a future if it had remained, you know, an FM station. Are there any music AM stations station down there anymore? Well, B would have been really marginalised if it had been there. And there were people that argued that that was appropriate, that BFM should have been a community station, and therefore AM was where it should have been. So, it, you know, that was the fine line that we had to negotiate. We were an alternative. We were filling a need, but it was important that you know, that need be filled in stereo. Mm. Oh, there really were people even within the station who argued that not enough people had FM radio, and nobody had FM radio in their car, and that we were going to be cutting out half our audience if we moved to FM. So, you know, there were even people that genuinely thought it was in the best interests of B to stay on AM. Obviously, they didn't prevail. And, you know, there were also a lot of people built on that afterwards too. I mean, we were still relatively low strength and, you know, inhibited by the student association structure and so forth. And a lot of people afterwards, you know, made a lot of other very fundamental changes to ensure the station's security and longevity in myriad ways. So it really has been an evolving process of building. There were people that were concerned that we were too serious, you know, that this was where, if you weren't into, you know, the whole vibe was relaxed and stoned, and they thought that we were trying to change the station by professionalising it, in not in terms of staff and so on, but in terms of trying to get it on a well-established footing. But the driving force for me was, I just thought that it was too fragile, that it would potentially end, and it was always struggling to pay the bills and struggling to get the next license, and it was trying to give the station some security in a future. It wasn't about trying to change it; it was about trying to preserve it, to give it something that it could grow from. To me, yeah. The appeal of B was always not just the fact that it played the latest alternative rock or whatever. It was the fact that it was so diverse, and I have such eclectic taste, and B covered it all. Mm. And none of those narrow cast stations, I mean, I love hip-hop, but I can't bear to listen to hip-hop non-stop
all the time. Mm.
And, you know, it's that range, it's that variety, and it's the constant change that I always thought was B's strength. And if that's still what B does, and, you know, I only get to hear it for a, you know, a little snippet over the summer, and it really gives me a very small window, because often the summer programming can be quite different. So if that's still what B does, then I'm sure B still is the only station that, and it's all played by people that love that genre and are choosing their own, you know, personal selection amongst it, and so you're getting the best of all those worlds, which is really, for me, what B was always about.
You are listening to 95 BFM right across Auckland City.
Now, Debbie, I want you to talk a little bit about when you finished at BFM.
I don't think I stopped anything all at once. It was sort of incrementally. I'd move from doing one thing to doing more of another thing. I'd get other people involved in, you know, the first few Boca Biffums were done on my bedroom floor, and then gradually more people got involved and we'd started being able to use Crack'em on the weekend and their dark room and so on. And once there was a critical mass of people that were interested in the fanzine, I dropped out of that and became more, you know, and did the record. It was just a sort of evolving thing, and I didn't actually ever stop until I was touring more with the Straitjackets than I was here. I was still DJing when I was managing them, and doing the orientation festival. I was involved with that for at least 2, maybe 3 years, doing the music side of orientation. And so it was just a continual ebb and flow of whatever fitted in around architecture school and the Straitjackets. And it was only when I was really travelling more than here that I dropped off completely. There was the Straitjackets that diverted me from ever being a practicing architect, really, because after I was still at architecture school while I was doing that and managing them, just as I finished my degree, I had finalised the deal with Rough Trade to release Hail through Europe and America and organise this whole tour, and I had a choice between doing window detailing and toilet specifications for some, you know, big architecture firm while I got my licence, or travelling through America and Europe with some of my favourite people playing my favourite music. And I just kind of went that way. No brainer. Who have we got next? Now, I'm glad to hear that this is going to be played within the vague proximity of Christmas, because this, for me, is the all-time best Christmas song ever. And it reminds me very much of my friend Jude, because she and I make sure we play it every year and dance and sing and yell and carry on. And it's just a classic, The Pogues.
It was Christmas Eve, babe, in the drunk tank, an old man said to me, won't see another one. And then he sang a song, the rare old mountain tune. I turned my face away and dreamed about you. Got on a lucky one, came in 18 to 1. I've got a feeling this year's for me and you. So happy Christmas, I love you, baby. I can see a better time when all our dreams come true.
You promised me Broadway was waiting for me. You were handsome,
you were pretty, queen of New York City.
When the band finished playing, they held out for more. Sinatra was swinging, all the drums they were singing. We kissed on the corner, then danced through the night. The boys of the NYPD choir were singing, go away, babe. And the bells were ringing out for Christmas Day.
Dripping that bed.
You scumbag, you maggot, cheap, lousy
been someone.
Well, so could anyone. You took my dreams from me when I first found you.
I kept them with me, babe. I put them with my own. Can't make it all alone. I built my dreams around you.
The boys of the NYPD chorus are singing "Go Away, Babe,"
and the bells are ringing out for Christmas Day.
As you said, you started to tour a lot with the Straitjacket Fits.
Mm-hmm. That was my prime passion for the next 5 or 6 years. Mm-hmm. Our first tour was 89. Probably I must have started with them in sort of 87 or 88. And then the first time we toured America and Europe was 89. I was actually emailed them all a couple of months ago, because on that first tour, we stumbled into Berlin the day after the wall came down, and it was total party madness, like all these East Germans just going nuts. And it was funny, I think it was either David or Shane described it as a scene from the Woody Allen Zelig movie, you know, this sort of monumental, because in America they were making a big fuss about the 20-year anniversary of the wall coming down. And it was just sort of random and bizarre that we were in the middle of it. Yeah. So that, there you go. That's when I pretty much, that was the beginning of the end of my time at B, was 20 years ago. That was what I was really focused on for the next wee while. I also, during that time, set up the BBC World Service down here for a while. That was sort of peripheral to, you know, to fill the time between tours and record releases and so on. It was just a lot of, you know, trying to get the records out and do the right thing and find the right combination. And so much in the music industry is about this amorphous, uncontrollable overlap of the zeitgeist with your tour and the media and the radio and the releases and all of those things, which are beyond any one person's ability to coordinate. And if they miss things, it just never, the dots don't connect and it doesn't quite happen. But, you know, we had some awesome moments. We had some funny moments. There were, yeah, it was a good time. The musical environment when you're making the record is quite different from by the time it's released. You know, things move a lot in 6 or 9 months. You sort of have to deliberately make what's not happening now, but that's not going to save it from potentially sounding dated when it comes out. It might be too early. I think some of the Straitjackets records were ahead of the grunge buzz, and if they'd come out a year later, they might have done better. There's all sorts of random things that you can't control. I remember, you know, the Straitjackets were signed to Arista for the second album. Lou Reed comes up again, because I have the entire Lou Reed catalogue, because he was on Arista and it was one of the first things I did when I walked in the door there.
Yeah, yes, I have those.
They were talking about setting up a whole parallel alternative record label, and that's another funny connection. The A&R guy that signed the Straitjacket Fits, his assistant, Tom Sarug, is now Lou's manager. There you go, Lou haunts us still. And they were supposed to be setting up this whole alternative parallel label that was going to have much more sort of interesting alternative music to, and to keep things away from, you know, Whitney, who paid the bills. and they were going to develop bands and so on, but it just wasn't in their blood. And they did have these incredibly credible artists like, you know, Lou and Patti Smith and all of those people, but the way the label was functioning at the time was very, very much pop focused. And they made one, what seemed at the time, minor change from, instead of having a parallel label, they just put in alternative departments. It was a big difference because it meant that instead of the alternative radio people working with the alternative marketing people and the alternative A&R people, the alternative radio people were working with the pop radio people. It didn't end up being the environment that we'd been promised or had envisaged. And I think that consequently, that didn't click. But there are always timing issues in things like you can't control when the record store displays your material prominently. You can't control when the magazines print their reviews. You can't control when the radio stations will pick up your song. And if those things coincidentally overlap, they build on each other. If they happen, and all of those things did happen for the Straitjackets, but when those things happen at different times, they don't ever create the kind of momentum that you can build from. They're just isolated incidents.
That's right.
It takes a very well-coordinated group of people to try to coordinate that, and even then it's not something you can control. All you can do is, in the middle of it all, there were some great songs, some great records, some awesome gigs, and some real challenges and some struggles and some hard work, but I wouldn't trade it for anything.
95 BFM.
Oh, I love this song.
This is another one that has a lot of personal associations, and this song was hitting right when in my last lot of DJing at BFM. It's written about one of the most amazing women in the whole world, who I adore, by a man I adore. And Chris sang the song for my sister at her wedding, and then Bo did a cover of it for Stroke, for the Benefit album for Chris, and one of my producers mixed Bo's version. But I'm going to go with the original, Chris Knox.
It's morning, time to wake now. Your body and mind entwined, we'll have to break now. But I want your flesh, your warmth to stay beside me. Oh, how I wish you could be deep inside me. Show me your eyes, your love, most tender feelings, and I'll give you mine. Be truthful in revealing, 'cause it's you that I love, and it's true that I love. It's love not given lightly, but I knew this was love, and it's you that I love, and it's more than what it might be. When we're alone, I cannot always face you. Maybe my mood won't let these arms embrace you, but that doesn't mean my love somehow diminished. Give me the time to show our love's unfinished, 'cause it's you that I love, and it's true that I love, and it's love not given lightly. But I knew this was love, and it's you that I love, and it's more than what it might be. I need your body, your mind, and your emotions. Shed me your tears till I drown in your oceans, 'cause it's you that I love, and it's true that I love. It's love not given lightly, but I knew this was love, and it's you that
Misha's mother. This isn't easy. I might not write another, but it's you that I love, and it's true that I love, and it's more than what it might be. And I knew this was a love, and it's you that I love, and it's love not given lightly. 'Cause it's you that I love, and it's true that I love, and it's love not given lightly. But I knew this was a love, and it's you that I love.
The final Straitjacket Fits tour was The Big Day Out, which was fantastic. The whole Australian Big Day Out, which I see Dimmer is doing this year, so I hope Shane has as much fun. They take such good care of you on that tour, and we had an amazing lineup that year. It was The Ramones and Soundgarden and Bjork and...
Oh, yeah.
Smashing Pumpkins and The Breeders, and I can't even think who else. It was a really fantastic lineup, and the Straitjackets. You know, the band had decided that they were breaking up before that tour, so it was really a nothing to prove, nothing to lose, just let's go out and last hurrah.
A good way to go out. Yeah.
And it was really, really fun. After the end of that tour in January, it was like, so now I have this window to start something new or do something different. And I suddenly thought, well, I don't need to do it here. I could do it somewhere else. So I just decided to move to New York because I'd spend a lot of the time there with the band. You know, they were signed to Arista, who were based in New York. So I spent a lot of time over there trying to prod them into doing the right thing around their releases. And booking agent was based in New York, Bob Lawton. He was fantastic, and I spent a lot of time with him. Our publishing company was there, so I'd spent many, many months in New York between tours and releases and so forth, setting things up, and had really fallen in love with the city. So I thought, if I'm starting from scratch and starting something new, let's see if we can do it there. And it sort of fell into place. I had become good friends with a woman in London who runs a producer management company, and she was having a baby and didn't want to travel in the States anymore, and asked if I would represent her guys in America. I did that for a couple of years, and I ended up taking on some of her clients for America permanently and building up my own client roster, and that's really what I've been doing ever since. Record producers, not bands. Uh-huh. You know, a producer will get a name for doing one kind of thing, but by the time they've established that reputation, they're really usually more interested musically in going somewhere else. So it's a matter of always trying to push the perception of them. And also, you really need to know your clients in terms of their personality, because, you know, some bands will want to experiment and want to be pushed and want someone who's going to throw new ideas at them, and they're often the older bands who have a really strong sense of their own identity and a sense of security about knowing what they like and what they don't like, so that they know that they can throw things out in the spur of the moment. They're not going to feel trapped. And you get young bands who are very defensive, and they just want you to catch what they do live. But of course, the studio is such a foreign environment that the key in those circumstances is about making them feel comfortable in a really foreign environment for a band, and making them feel inspired when they're playing on their own in an isolation chamber rather than playing with their bandmates
in front of an audience.
So each producer, whether it's their sonic skills, their musical affinities, their personality traits, the way they deal with people. And you really need to be dealing with a manager or an A&R person that knows their artist as well, because that's when you really make a successful combination and put people together that bring out the best in each other. I mean, usually it's more the fact that, you know, you deliver a brilliant record and the record, you have absolutely no input into what the label does with it. And I used to love that side of things, and you don't have any say at all. The number of really, really great records that get buried is amazing. You would be amazed.
Yeah. Yes.
Or just the wrong promotion, the wrong single. You know, you sit there thinking, they're releasing what as a single? That's just bizarre. You know, I've been listening to this record for 6 months and it's really obvious that that's the song. But you can't say anything. You're just, you know, it's one thing that I miss about the band management is that you're not involved in that whole promotional end of it. You're
choosing
only
the song. Yeah.
Yeah, you just have to, you know, you deliver the audio and you can't, you have no input into the visuals, the single selection, the videos, the tour combination, that none of that. You just have to give it to them, cross your fingers and look the other way.
Well, right now you can choose a song.
Oh, excellent. Well, this is brand new. It's being released in, I think, February on Sub Pop. One of my producers produced and mixed this band. They're called Beach House. They're a local Brooklyn band in New York. And again, it's somewhat wistful, but it's a really great album. So this song is at radio, I think, in the States this month, but the actual record should be out in the new year.
Debbie, thank you so much for coming in today. I'm stoked to be able to have you on here for our final episode. Now, I'd like you to reflect a little. BFM is 40 years old this year. Quite a remarkable achievement. Your thoughts on that?
I think 40 is fantastic, personally. I would thoroughly encourage BFM to enjoy its 40s. It can be, you know, I would hope that B were a little more stable than it was in its 20s. I hope we're all a little bit more stable than we were in our 20s. But really, I think that if it's found its niche and found its form and enjoying where it's at, then I hope the station and everyone involved relishes that.
You have a last song.
Okay, well, this is another guy who's been haunting me for many, many years since the BFM promoted Looney Tours birthday party tours, which was one of my favourite gigs to seeing Nick Cave play numerous times. You know, I remember when I was training for I did the New York Marathon once, and when I was training, I was listening to Nick Cave's Murder Ballads, which I have to say, the only thing that I went out for a 4-hour run with that was less appropriate than Nick Cave's Murder Ballads was the audiobook of Einstein's Theory of Relativity. I just don't know what I was thinking that was something inspiring that you could run to. That was a long run. But anyway, Nick I've just always loved Nick Cave and anything he does. And the song was one that I loved first time around. And then it came back when I became a mum and along came the Shrek movies and all those fantastic bands that I loved when I was at B and writing reviews for The Listener and so forth, like came back in the Shrek soundtrack, and this was amongst them, and I learned to love it all over again in a completely different context.
Just ain't no good. A thing that's well understood. You can see it everywhere you look. People just ain't no good. We were married under cherry trees. Blossom, we made our vows. All the blossoms come sailing down through the streets and through the playground. The sun would stream on the sheets, woken by the morning bird. By the Sunday newspapers, I never read a single word. People, they ain't no good. People, they ain't no good. People, they ain't no good. Seasons came, seasons went. The winter stripped the blossoms bare. A different tree now lines the streets, shaking its fists in the air. The winter slammed us like a fist. Rattling in the gales, to which she drew the curtains.
two aloes and a dozen wild lilies, two aloes and a coffin of wood, two aloes and all the pink-eyed pigeons coo, that people, they just ain't no good. Two aloes and back all the letters, to our love, Valentine of blood. To our love, let all the jilted lovers cry. The people, they just ain't no good. It ain't that in their hearts they're bad. They can comfort you, some even try. Nurse you when you're ill of health, they bury you when you go and die. It ain't that in their hearts they're bad, they'll stick by you if they could. Ah, but that's just bullshit, baby. People just ain't no good. People ain't no good. People ain't no good. People ain't no good. People, they ain't no good. People, they ain't no good. People, they ain't no good.
You have been listening to the BFM Historical Society, a weekly radio documentary series made to commemorate BFM's 40th anniversary. This week was the final installment, and I would like to thank all the subjects who have come in, shared their music and memories of the station, and especially like to thank Troy Ferguson, who has done a sterling job of editing and research.
Happy birthday, BFM! 40 years of independent radio. Apart from those two where we weren't, or whatever.
This is radio for the...